You saw it looked like lightning in the sky, but it wasn't actually lightning. It was the power boxes all exploding in the air. It was nuts looking.
Assessing the damage from Hurricane Milton as Catholic relief agencies spring into action. We remember the attacks of October 7th on the one-year anniversary and talked to a kibbutz survivor who said prayer saved her life. The last of a generation farewell to a Kennedy family matriarch. And the unique sound of the carillon. We get a music lesson high up in the steeple of an Irish cathedral. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Sounded like a train. It was pretty rough. A lot of damage around the houses, but most of the houses, I think, did pretty good, Shockingly.
Residents in the Tampa Bay area breathe a sigh of relief. There were not historic storm surges. Yet Hurricane Milton makes its mark on Central Florida just 2 weeks after Hurricane Helene hits northern Florida and heads up to the Carolinas. Emergency rescue workers find at least 14 dead in this most recent storm, which leaves billions of dollars behind in property damage and millions of homes and businesses without power. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Hurricane Milton had at one point strengthened to a top Category 5 hurricane, headed straight for Tampa with a killer storm surge. It came ashore on Wednesday night as a Cat 3. Though Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said it was not the worst-case scenario, Milton still left a swath of destruction. Within hours, emergency search and rescue teams had pulled nearly 1,000 people from their homes and flooded neighborhoods. In the Tampa area, they were going door to door to check on trapped residents. In St. Petersburg, fierce winds ripped the fabric off of the roof of Tropicana Field, home of the Tampa Bay Rays baseball team. Power was knocked out for more than 3 million residents and may take weeks to restore. The storm's sustained winds of 125 miles per hour caused massive damage, blowing off roofs, crushing homes. Because of repeated recent weather disasters in Florida, many homeowners can no longer afford property insurance and may not be able to rebuild. The hurricane triggered a record 120-plus tornado warnings, the most ever in one day in Florida. On the east coast of Florida, this roof blew off of a church. The pastor vows to rebuild.
Our heart breaks for what's happening right now in our community and the people reeling. There's still hope in our world, and the community is here for you. You're not going through this alone.
Meteorologists say perhaps the most surprising aspect of Milton was the number and strength of tornadoes it spawned in central and southern Florida. Once the number of tornado touchdowns are confirmed by the Weather Service, Milton could go down as one of the most prolific tornado-producing hurricanes. Meanwhile, Florida's northern neighbors continue the long road to recovery after a devastating Hurricane Helene just 2 weeks ago. More than half of the 238 confirmed deaths occurred in North Carolina, where tens of thousands still remain without power and even running water. Search and rescue continues in mountainous regions, and state lawmakers have approved more than $200 million to support relief efforts. Catholic Charities USA is deeply involved in getting help to those impacted by the hurricanes. For the very latest on that, we are joined by Kim Burgo. She is Vice President for Disaster Operations at Catholic Charities USA. She has spent decades in disaster relief and is regarded by many as the preeminent disaster relief expert in the church today. Kim, thank you for joining us. I know you recently returned home after being on the road at these sites of the hurricane aftermath. We have had back-to-back hurricanes now slam the southeast region within 2 weeks' time. From your perspective, how has this hurricane season compared to those in recent years when it comes to the damage and scale?
Yeah, I mean, back-to-back hurricanes is always a challenge. The first one was very, very bad. I toured both the Tampa area and the Asheville, North Carolina area, and it was just absolutely devastating. And, of course, to have the Tampa area get hit again by Milton is just horrible and certainly a great loss, again, for the people who first suffered from Helene.
Absolutely. I can't imagine just the distress it places on the local community. Kim, what is Catholic Charities doing right now to provide the immediate relief to Floridians impacted by Hurricane Milton?
Yeah, so the baseline of relief is to make sure that people have food, water, shelter, and safety. And so people can't even expect to work towards their recovery unless they have those items. And so that is what our Catholic Charities agencies in Florida are working on now, making sure that they have adequate shelter, that they have food, that they have the immediate needs, that they do feel safe, that they have water. So this is done through distribution sites that are set up throughout the state. We do have a large warehouse in the middle of the state of Florida that is actively sending supplies to our Catholic Charities agencies as they need them, and they are being distributed to the community rapidly.
These basic needs for survival. But Kim, we also know that people will need assistance, yes, in the immediate hurricane aftermath, but there are lasting long-term impacts when families lose their homes and belongings. So how will Catholic Charities continue to walk alongside these families amid devastation from Hurricane Milton?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly, you know, the rest of America may not see the news anymore about the devastation from these hurricanes, but I guarantee you that these hurricanes, for the families that it affected, will last up to 5 years. And that's something that Catholic Charities is very proud of. We are in the community for the life of the community. And so therefore, you know, putting to practice our own Catholic social teachings of solidarity, we work and walk with clients till the time that they feel that they're safe, self-sustainable again. Mm. So that's done through case management services. It's done through information and referral services and the whole host of services that are available to by Catholic Charities on a sunny day.
Mm. Kim, keeping our eye on the Tampa Bay area, which was hit by these back-to-back hurricanes, earlier this year, we reported on the opening of Hope Cottages at the Tampa Hope Homeless Shelter, launched by Catholic Charities in the Diocese of St. Petersburg. These innovative cottage homes for people who are homeless. Do you know, Kim, how did these cottages withstand the storm? And how is Catholic Charities specifically attending to the needs of people who are homeless at this time?
Yeah, that's also a great question. So I've been working very closely with the executive director there in Tampa. She, of course, is an expert at this. And so she quickly evacuated all the residents of the homeless shelters that are part of Catholic Charities of St. Petersburg and got them into a safe space. Mm-hmm. I do know that the Tampa Hope facility is up and operational again with no problems. The other shelters are being assessed for safety and hope that we can get residents back in there as well. But it did survive the storm, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely. No, that's great to hear. Looking back now on Hurricane Helene, can you give us an update? What is Catholic Charities doing to continue to assist those hardest hit from Hurricane Helene 2 weeks ago, specifically in North Carolina and in eastern Tennessee?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, food, water, shelter, and safety is the basis of everything that we do at first. And so there are distribution sites set up in Tennessee and in North Carolina and in Florida and in Charleston, South Carolina, and I believe Georgia. They're all across these areas that were hardest hit by Helene. And they are providing the immediate services right now and will transition into the longer-term disaster case management services as they move forward. But certainly, it's ever-evolving. I can tell you, just literally, I came back yesterday afternoon. Mm-hmm. And in the night before, I was looking at cadaver dogs that were still searching for bodies. So this is still a very active, ongoing disaster. You're looking at rescuing people or recovering people at this point. It's very, very sensitive. And so this isn't a quick fix.
No, not at all. Oh, my goodness. You know, Kim, we have just under a minute left, but I do want to ask you, there's been a lot of chatter this week about hurricane relief misinformation. From your perspective, have you noticed an uptick in the spread of misinformation? And has that been a hurdle to providing people help and assistance?
Well, I don't know whether it's been an uptick. I think that misinformation exists in every disaster. It doesn't matter whether it was 2020 or 2024. Misinformation is always out there. And that's because people, become confused during the time of a disaster. And so they might not hear things correctly, and they might share that information with their neighbor. I would highly recommend that if you are hearing something that isn't quite right, go to the source. Really look at trying to verify from the source what is the correct information. And that has to do with contractors, that has to do with emergency management, whatever it may be. You know, don't be duped by misinformation. Always check out with a reliable source.
That is a great reminder. Kim Burgo, thank you for your work on the front lines. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can support the hurricane relief effort by making a donation. Go to CatholicCharitiesUSA.org to learn more. Next on EWTN News in Depth, we turn to the remembrance 1 year later of the horror that befell Israel on October
7th.
I have some kind of feeling that we will always live in ruin. It doesn't matter what side we will be on, left, right, Arab or Jew. And it's a bit sad.
A country and the world mourn the loss of lives on October 7th and plea for the release of those still held hostage. And a Catholic survivor of October 7th joins us to discuss her horrifying experience in her first ever television interview about that fateful day. The role she says prayer had in her survival when we return.
I can't believe it's been 1 year already. I really miss them, and I am so afraid that I will not see them again, and I'm really afraid that the next time I see them will be a very big funeral for all of them.
1 year later, and still no sign of freedom. Elon Keshet continues to mourn his four family members who were taken hostage by Hamas on October 7th. 101 hostages remain in Gaza. No one knows whom among them is still alive, as Israel's offensive on Hamas shows no end in sight. It has been 1 year since Hamas launched its unprecedented terrorist attack on Israel. It was the largest assault on the Jewish people since the Holocaust and has since spiraled into a broader conflict in the Middle East. People around the world commemorated the sorrowful anniversary. In a place once filled with music, now silent, only broken by cries. Hundreds of mourners gathered at the site of the Nova Music Festival in Israel, where more than 380 people were killed by Hamas on October 7th. The terrorist attack launched by Iran-backed Hamas last year was completely unexpected, catching Israeli security forces off guard on a major Jewish holiday. The assault was carried out in areas filled with civilians, from the music festival to rural kibbutz near the border. 1,200 people lost their lives, making the attack the deadliest in Israel's history. Hamas took 251 people hostage, dozens of whom are still held captive and many presumed dead.
There are still people kept alive, and some of them are already murdered in Hamas hands for a year. This is, you know, agonizing.
In the year since the attack, tensions in the region have escalated into war. Israel's near-daily military tit-for-tat with Lebanon's Hezbollah has become its own deadly conflict. And its counteroffensive in Gaza has spurred an ever-growing humanitarian crisis. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, many of them women and children. The rest of the displaced population finds itself in a struggle for basic necessities like shelter, clean water, and food. Israel has faced international condemnation for its offensive in Gaza. But on this anniversary, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promised the war will continue.
We will end the war when we complete all the goals we set, collapsing the evil rule of Hamas, returning all our hostages home, both the dead and the living, thwarting any future threat from Gaza to Israel, and returning our residents in the south and north safely to their homes.
Israelis remember the anniversary with somber ceremonies throughout the day.
Family members of those killed or kidnapped by Hamas gathered in Tel Aviv for a memorial service, while a state-sanctioned ceremony took place in a small town on the Gaza border. Jewish communities around the world, from Europe to Africa, led prayer services. At the Vatican, Pope Francis, who has spoken out against the war often, offered a rosary for peace on the eve of the anniversary.
Padre, Figlio, Spirito Santo.
In the United States, the White House held its own ceremony. President Joe Biden joined a rabbi in saying a Hebrew prayer of remembrance for those lives lost.
V'nomar Amen.
In a statement released on Monday, Biden promised his administration will not stop working to achieve a ceasefire deal in Gaza that brings the hostages home, allows for a surge in humanitarian aid to ease the suffering on the ground, assures Israel security, and ends the war. Throughout the United States, memorials and protests erupted, some in support of Israel and the hostages, others for Palestine and calling for a ceasefire. At Columbia University, protesters on both sides of the issue had a presence. Months after pro-Palestinian and anti-Semitic protests rocked the campus and many others.
Never again.
As Israel continues its offensives in Gaza to the west and Lebanon to the north, it faces greater pressure from global leaders to put an end to the violence. For those who survived the October 7th attack, the road to healing continues.
It's sort of a milestone for so many things. Being taken hostage, for losing my home, for losing my husband that I actually didn't know that I had lost him for two more months. But it's like all of those things together, and the situation is still so horrible. I don't think anybody expected the war to be going on for so long, and for the things that have happened in the last months to happen. So it's very, very depressing.
We are joined now by Monica Boboso, a Catholic who was working as a caregiver at a kibbutz Hamas terrorists attacked on October 7th. She recounted her horrifying experience in a powerful article this week published by EWTN's Catholic news agency. Monica and the elderly woman she cares for were the only people in her kibbutz neighborhood to survive the attack. Understandably traumatized by the events of October 7th, before now, Monica has never spoken on camera about what happened to her that day. Monica, I thank you for joining us and for sharing your story. I can't even imagine how difficult it is to recall what you lived through on October 7th, 2023. Looking back on that tragic day 1 year ago, how did you first know that you were under attack and how did you find shelter?
Yeah, first, I'm awake with a bomb. I hear the bombing, a sound of bombing in our surroundings and the shooting guns. And I get up, I called my friend, I asked them if they heard also. And after that, I heard the alarm, siren alarm. And I go to the bomb shelter first. I didn't go to Esther to get her because all the time they told us, the family, our manager, that if there is sirens, we need to go first. If we cannot bring our employer, we need to save ourselves first. Mm-hmm. And I go to the shelter. After 10 minutes, I go to Esther and bring her to the bathroom, change everything, give her food, give her medicine. And I heard everything outside, the shooting guns, and also I saw them outside the house. They are running, the terrorists. And that's why I know that it's very, it's war already because I heard a shooting gun, bombing, yeah. And I'm very scared at that time.
I bet.
And I don't know what to do.
Mm. And then you went into a bomb shelter and you were in there for 16 hours with the elderly woman that you care for, Esther Rott. What were you praying during that time, during those 16 hours? What was going through your mind?
Yeah, first I prayed that God, please make them blind so that they cannot see us, so that they cannot go inside our house, they cannot attack us. And I told and also I prayed, please give me strength, power, and protect us, save us. And I keep repeating like that. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, they put the grenade in the window. So they go inside, and they try to open the doorknob of the door of the mamad, of the bomb shelter. And I'm trying to push it that they cannot open. I'm trying to hold it every time. 5 times they're trying to open, but I'm holding it. And I don't know how I am very strong that time, because I'm still praying, God, please give me strength, give me power, don't let them to open the door, please help me. And that time they didn't open, they cannot open the door. That's why I believe God is with me all the time.
I mean, that's so powerful to hear you say how Hamas broke into your house with explosives and eventually set fire to your house, and everything burned except for one thing. And that was your rosary. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I didn't know also how my rosary still burned, but not everything. And I don't know also, because every night before I go to sleep, I pray a rosary. And all the time it's my bedside. And after a month, when we came back, I saw it. It's still in the floor. And I cried a lot, because I know that rosary saved me. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. You have a devotion to Our Lady in the Rosary, and sounds like she just had her mantle wrapped around you that day.
Yes, very.
And Monica, looking back on October 7th, about 1,200 lives were lost on that day. You and Esther, the woman you care for, were the only two people who survived in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
When you reflect on that, why do you think God protected you? Why do you think that you are alive today?
Yeah, because all the time I prayed, I know he heard me. Because also I told Esther, please, Esther, pray that God will save us, because there is a war, there is a terrorist, there is Hamas outside. Please pray that he will save us. And I know Esther is do it also. And I know that because all the time when I'm praying, it's like he answered my prayer. Yeah. And he gave me strength. He don't let me nothing happen to us, because at the end I'm so very weak already. And I told him, God, if it's my time, please take care of my children. But he didn't let it.
That is an important part of your story, that you are also a wife and a mother. And a year later, how are you and Esther doing today?
It's very terrified. At 3 months, I cannot go out. I cannot do anything. All the time, I'm afraid. And every time I have a nightmare, I can't sleep.
Finally, Monica, as a Catholic, can you share, do you feel a solidarity with our Jewish brothers and sisters in the wake of the October 7th attack?
Yeah. I still feel solidarity for them, and still close for them, because I know they are very good person. They are good people, and they treat us like their own family members. When they are eating, they want also to eat together. Mm-hmm. And there is a holiday, we are celebrating together. Like we are not other people.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I know Jewish people is a good people.
Monica, I will just pray for your continued healing following that tragic day 1 year ago. I thank God for your life, and I thank you for joining us this week. God bless you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And the fighting continues as Israel targets the Hamas terrorists in Gaza who perpetuated the October 7th attack and as the fight expands regionally. This week, Israel and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon continued to trade cross-border fire, including an Israeli airstrike on what is called weapon storage facilities in a southern suburb of Beirut. The Israeli security cabinet was also holding meetings to vote on the country's response to Iran's October first missile attack on Israel. Though there have been ongoing discussions between top diplomats, on Wednesday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to President Joe Biden on the phone for the first time in 7 weeks. In its response to Iran, Biden urged Netanyahu not to hit sites related to Iran's nuclear program or the oil sector, which could result to spikes in global energy prices. Next, Pope Francis schedules his next consistory for later this year as he elevates a new slate of cardinals. Some delegates to the Synod on Synodality want to discuss women in the diaconate. It is officially off the table, but that does not mean the questions are going away. An EWTN correspondent at the Vatican joins us to explain. And later, we're off to Ireland to talk to the musician who makes magic with the bells of St. Colman's. Pope Francis announced this week he will hold a consistory in December for the creation of new cardinals. The Holy Father has named 21 new cardinals, a diverse group of appointees from all over the world, from Brazil to Britain, Algeria to Japan, though none from the United States. The youngest cardinal elect is 44, whereas the oldest is 99 years old. The Holy Father appointed one new cardinal in all of North America, Archbishop Francis Leo of the Archdiocese of Toronto, who has served the Canadian Archdiocese in this role for little more than a year. And just weeks ago, our own Monse Alvarado spoke with him in Toronto, where he shared how the faithful can support new bishops and new cardinals.
I would ask them to please pray for me every day. I would ask them to get closer to Jesus. In getting closer to Jesus and encountering Jesus, there will be an abundant outpour of grace and blessing upon my ministry, the ministry of the pastors, and the entire church.
The consistory will take place on December 8th, the Solemnity of the Immaculate Conception at the Vatican. The final meeting of the Synod on Synodality just rounded out its first full week, and on Tuesday, it announced the members of a key group who will shape the Synod's final text. The 14 members comprise of Synod leaders and representatives from all corners of the Church. The group will supervise the theological experts who prepare the final document. That final document will offer concrete proposals about how to expand participation in ecclesial decision-making and the role of women in the Church. Most of the members of this new commission were also in last year's commission on the final document. On day one of the Synod's working sessions, the Vatican's doctrinal chief shut down speculation about further theological study into the possibility of women being ordained as deacons. The head of the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, made the announcement on the Synod's first official working day. Fernandez stated in part that the Dicastery judges that there is still no room for a positive decision by the Magisterium regarding the access of women to the diaconate. The Synod's working document reveals that the female diaconate is off the table for official discussion, but that has not prevented the topic from coming up at Vatican press briefings this week.
Even if, as of at the moment, we may not be looking at ordained ministry, I think, you know, the, what I would say about that is we tend to look at it from the question of can women or can they not be ordained in the church today? And I think we have to look at the question very much from the, you know, the Spirit. Is the Spirit calling women? Because some women do sense a call to priesthood or diaconate.
That was Synod Delegate Sister Mary Teresa Barron, who currently leads a Catholic organization representing 600,000 religious sisters from 80 countries. Correspondent Christina Malare has written extensively on this topic for Catholic news agency. She joins us now from the EWTN Vatican Bureau to discuss. Christina, thank you for joining us. Can you break down, first off, what Cardinal Fernandez said on the onset of the Synod about the possibility of women being ordained as deacons?
Yes, so on the very first working day of the Synod on October 2, he made it quite clear that women do not have access to the diaconate in holy orders. So he did speak about this very clearly. Plus, in addition, he did talk about there needs to be more study into what other ministries women can do and how they can be in positions of responsibility within the Catholic Church. He wanted to divert the attention of people to looking at like a broader way in which women are participating, and not necessarily with the sacrament of holy orders. So, for example, he drew upon the examples of saints are very powerful and influential women throughout history. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Saint Catherine of Siena, mm-hmm. Saint Teresa of Avila, these are women who had extensive authority in the church, mm-hmm. even to the Pope himself, they've been able to talk to them. So again, this is the direction in which Fernandez would like to draw the conversation. Mm-hmm. However, as you have mentioned, there are many voices who are participating in the Synod who have very different ideas mm-hmm. about this. But it's very clear from Fernandez himself and from the Magisterium of the Church, there is a note to women deacons.
And Christina, there is a synod study group that's focused on the subject of women deacons. What more can you tell us about this group and that group's purpose?
Okay, so this group, it's study group number 5, and they are looking more specifically at the theological and canonical matters regarding ministerial forms within the church. So under this as well would include women deacons. It's a lot broader, but however, it's very apparent that the topic of women being ordained as deacons is very popular in the media and also, mm-hmm. as well as among other Catholic circles throughout the world in different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So they are studying a broad range of issues. But in addition to this study group, if we're going to talk more specifically about the issue of women deacons, the Pope has also set up 2 separate commissions to look into this a lot further. But study group number 5 of the Synod on Synodality is looking at this, but there are other issues involved as well, not just women and their access to the deacon, to the diaconate. Mm,
thank you for that clarification. And Christina, I want to take a listen to what Pope Francis told CBS News earlier this year on the topic of women deacons.
I understand you have said no women as priests, but you are studying the idea of women as deacons. Is that something you are open to?
If it is deacons with holy orders, no.
Pretty clear there. Christina, what else has Pope Francis said on this topic? And could it be interpreted by some that by creating these study groups and commissions on women deacons, he's sidelining the issue?
I know that the Pope has received a lot of criticism, particularly even in Belgium and in his last apostolic journey, about what he's had to say about women, and not specifically just about women deacons. However, it's very clear from what the Pope said, he's not sidelining the issue. Number one, he has created 2 separate commissions in addition, which is outside the Synod of Synodality. He's also written about the amazing contribution that women make to the life of the church. So if you look at Evangelii Gaudium, so an apostolic exhortation, he talks about the valuable contribution of women. Mm. In addition to that, he's also spoken about women as catechists. Again, this is an instituted ministry within the church and how women have contributed greatly to that. So it's not so much that the Pope is sidelining the issue. In fact, he is studying it, and he's gotten other people to look at it from a theological point of view, as well as from the canon, looking at it there as well. But I don't think it could be right or accurate to say that the Pope is sidelining the issue. If it's talking about women deacons, I think he's made it very clear.
Very clear. Christina, we played a clip of a Synod delegate, Sister Mary Teresa Barron, saying some women do sense a call to the priesthood or diaconate. How significant are these comments, and are there other notable comments from other Synod members on this?
This is very interesting. Since the opening of the Synod, there have been daily press briefings. Just to give a little bit of insight without sharing too much with the general public what is happening inside. However, almost every single press briefing has been a comment about women as well as women deacons. You can also see journalists who are present there who are trying to come in and talk about women deacons, but coming in from a different angle. So besides Sister Mary's comments, there's also been some notable comments that have come from prelates. So, for example, you had the Australian bishop, Anthony Randazzo, who is representing Oceania, saying that he thinks that we should stop talking about women and start talking with women. Mm-hmm. So he mentioned that the Pope has already set up this study group. He's already set up these commissions. We need to talk more about ways which women and also lay women can contribute in the life of the church. He had very strong words. He actually said that Catholics have to be aware as well of a possible new ideological colonialism, which focuses on very niche matters. So he's talking and he's representing a region where maybe the issue of women deacons isn't particularly prominent. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, and in many countries that are in Oceania, there's a lot of concern more about, say, women, their health, mm-hmm. and if they're safe, and making sure that they're not second-class citizens. And he said this is scandalous, that in parts of the world, women are experiencing this sort of discrimination. And he thinks talking about women deacons is not even giving the chance for people to talk about these very real matters.
But could be a distraction.
And women are having to really fight for their lives.
Right. It could be a distraction instead. Christina, thank you so much for your reporting and your time on this.
Yeah, it could be very much a distraction. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Christina and other EWTN journalists from Catholic News Agency and the National Catholic Register have already provided extensive reporting from the Synod. For broadcast, EWTN editorial director Dr. Matthew Bunsen and I will join the team in Rome, along with Father Thomas Petrie of the Dominican House of Studies, with TV coverage and commentary during the Synod's closing week, October 21st through the 27th. Pope Francis welcomed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky back to the Vatican on Friday morning. The visit was part of Zelensky's so-called victory tour across Europe, an attempt to garner support for a just end to the war with Russia. Pope Francis has prayed often for peace in Ukraine since the conflict began more than 2 years ago. This is their second meeting this year after speaking with each other at the G7 in June. Other news headlines are next. In the Week in Review, a Kennedy matriarch has passed away, ghost guns at the U.S. Supreme Court, and Kamala Harris and the Knights of Columbus. We'll be right back. The death of a legendary figure in the Kennedy family tops the Week in Review. 96-year-old Ethel Kennedy passed away on Thursday after suffering a stroke last week. The widow of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, she was a lifelong Catholic and daily communicant whose life was marked by a series of Kennedy family tragedies. She was just 40 years old and pregnant with her 11th child when RFK was assassinated in 1968. Stoic in public, she was reluctant, even in private, to discuss that dark period of her life. An enthusiastic supporter of the Kennedy family legacy, she was a steady presence in a family which suffered other tragedies, including the death of one son by drug overdose and another in a skiing accident. Just months after her husband's death, she founded the nonprofit organization Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights and was a frequent behind-the-scenes influencer in the Washington political and social scene. Her son, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., ran as an independent for president this year before dropping out. With less than 1 month before Election Day, it is down to the wire on the campaign trail for candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. The former president has spent much of the week concentrating on and visiting the battleground states. On Thursday in Reading, Pennsylvania, Trump told the crowd to vote early and said if he wins Pennsylvania, he wins the whole thing. And then on Thursday in Detroit, Michigan, he made remarks to the Detroit Economic Club in an effort to appeal to the auto industry and to slam high tariffs on imports. For her part, Harris made a round of media appearances trying to reach out to undecided voters and those so-called low propensity voters who don't often go to the polls. In a string of interviews from 60 Minutes to The View to more controversial shows like the Call Her Daddy podcast and the Howard Stern radio show, she reached out to different demographics of the electorate. And on Thursday evening, she reached out to Hispanic viewers in a town hall meeting broadcast by Univision. Kamala Harris's relationship to Catholics and Catholic beliefs have been an ongoing topic of conversation this campaign cycle. In the past, she's had stern questions for judicial candidates who are members of the Knights of Columbus, the world's largest Catholic fraternal organization. Now that past scrutiny is bringing renewed scrutiny to her campaign.
Every day, courtroom, I stood proudly before a judge, and I said five words: Kamala Harris for the people.
Kamala Harris is making her case to become the prosecutor president. As a U.S. senator from California, she earned a reputation for being a tenacious questioner, especially of judicial nominees.
Can you think of any laws that give government the power to make decisions about the male body?
I'm happy to answer a more specific question.
There are some questions Harris asked in the Senate Judiciary Committee that Catholic voters may want to know about.
In Article 6 of the Constitution, it very explicitly bans religious tests for public office. And that's precisely what Kamala Harris did.
In May 2018, in written questions for the nomination of Peter Phipps for the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania, then-Senator Harris noted Phipps' membership in the Catholic fraternal organization, the Knights of Columbus, asking if he carried out the Knight's mission of defending the right to life of every human being from the moment of conception to natural death. In November of that same year, Harris scrutinized another Knight's membership, that time with nominee Paul Mady, as he was being considered for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. She asked if Mady was aware the Knights of Columbus opposed a woman's right to choose and whether he believes that a fetus is entitled to any protection under the U.S. Constitution. And then in December 2018, Harris grilled a third judicial nominee over his Knight's involvement, Brian Bisher, who was nominated to the U.S. District Court for the District of Nebraska. Harris stated the Knights have, quote, taken a number of extreme positions and asked, among other questions, whether Bisher believed abortion is the killing of the innocent on a massive scale.
I mean, really inappropriate questions that have nothing to do with a person's ability and their loyalty to this country and their previous service.
Catholic attorney Mary Fiorito looks back on Harris's zeroing in on the largest Catholic fraternal organization in the world.
As someone who was running for higher office, they're always looking to where their big donors are standing. And of course, two of her hugest donors have been, you know, advocacy groups for redefinition of marriage and advocacy groups for abortion.
In response to Harris's past scrutiny of the Knights, the Archdiocese of San Francisco, where Harris got her political start, tells EWTN News in Depth, any reasonable and informed person would not disparage members of one of the world's largest charitable organizations that supports widows, orphans, and the less fortunate. The Knights of Columbus adhere to the highest standards of professional, ethical, and moral conduct.
I want to ask you a hard question. Are you now or have you ever been involved in the organization of a fish fry?
as a consumer, I have.
Former U.S. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska spotlighted the concerns during one nominee's confirmation, while also taking action against it, introducing a religious test resolution, which passed in the Senate.
The resolution simply says that it is the sense of the Senate that disqualifying a nominee for the federal bench or for any federal office on the basis of his or her Catholic beliefs or membership in the Knights of Columbus violates the no religious test clause of the Constitution.
EWTN News reached out to the Harris presidential campaign for comment about her questioning over Knights of Columbus membership and has not heard back. But the founder of the group Catholics for Harris tells EWTN News in Depth in part, quote, I can confidently say that Vice President Harris deeply respects and admires our Catholic faith. While neither she nor former President Trump fully embraces all of Catholic teaching, she proudly defends core components of our faith in her public service.
The Constitution certainly does not allow religious tests for office. It's right there in writing. No religious test should be applied. And I think that asking a person whether they are members of the Knights of Columbus certainly runs up against that prohibition in the Constitution.
Journalist and historian Matthew Continetti says the mainstream media is memory-holing some of Harris's past extreme actions, but advises Christian and Catholic voters to not also fall into forgetting.
I do think that is a major concern, and I do think it should be on people's minds. as they decide for whom to vote in November. Until she actually renounces them, until she actually goes before the American people and says, you know what, it was wrong for me to single out that district court judge nominee on the basis of his faith, well, then she should be absolutely held to account for her views.
I just would caution listeners to be very careful if you're told that, you know, Kamala Harris wants to be the president for everyone. She wants to be a uniter, because we have not seen her lead by example in that regard.
These three court nominees Harris questioned about the Knights of Columbus were all eventually approved by the Senate to the federal bench. In the meantime, Harris has declined to attend the annual Al Smith Charity Dinner in New York next Thursday. Since 1960, the event has traditionally hosted the presidential candidates every 4 years for a good-natured evening of roasting and political jokes. In a move which Trump has since highly criticized, Harris said she will be campaigning and unavailable to attend. Trump says he will be there. Harris said if elected president, she hopes to attend the annual event in upcoming years. The U.S. Supreme Court has started the fall term with a major case about the legality of so-called ghost guns. The justices seemed poised to maintain regulations on the homemade firearms. The case concerns the Biden administration's 2022 regulations of ghost guns, which requires background checks, serial numbers, and sales records. Ghost guns are made at home using kits or 3D printed parts and have been nearly untraceable. Second Amendment groups, parts makers, and gun owners brought the case against the Biden administration because they feel the government exceeded its authority. During oral arguments, the justices turned to colorful analogies to understand when a partly assembled gun may be considered a firearm, from cars and IKEA furniture to omelets.
There. If I show you, I put out on a counter some eggs, some chopped up ham, some chopped up pepper and onions. Is that a Western omelet?
No, because again, those items have well-known other uses to become something other than an omelet. The key difference here is that these weapon parts kits are designed and intended to be used as instruments of combat, and they have no other conceivable use.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says the number of ghost guns confiscated by law enforcement have increased tenfold and are increasingly appearing in investigations of homicide or attempted homicide. The court will release its decision by June of next year. The High Court also denied the Biden administration's effort to force Texas doctors to perform abortions in emergency situations. The move follows a long legal battle over the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which the administration says requires abortions in emergency situations, even in states where unborn life is legally protected. The Supreme Court's dismissal on Monday means the Biden administration cannot enforce this policy in Texas. Last term, the justices punted a similar case arising out of Idaho, allowing the federal government to force emergency room doctors to perform abortions. And an update to a story we brought you last week. In a 6-1 majority, the Georgia Supreme Court reinstated the state's life-affirming heartbeat law. While its legal battle continues, a trial court judge overturned the legislation Monday. The law limits abortion in Georgia after the 6th week of pregnancy, around the time a heartbeat can be heard. Tens of thousands of people are expected in Washington, D.C. on Friday, January 24th for the 52nd annual March for Life on the National Mall. The theme announced this week is Every Life, Why We March. The keynote speaker is famed surfer and pro-life advocate Bethany Hamilton. As we do every year, EWTN will provide live coverage beginning at 9 a.m. Eastern.
Next, music from the heights. We introduce you to a musician who climbs to the sky to create a heavenly sound. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
Dedication to making beautiful music ring far and wide is the inspiration for a very special church musician in Ireland. Every time he plays, he has to climb up 200 steps, and every time he practices, an entire town can hear him, whether he hits a wrong note or not. This musician plays the carillon and shared his love for the instrument with correspondent Colm Flynn.
Ringing out around the Irish town of Cove in County Cork in Ireland are the bells of St. Colman's Cathedral, playing Hail Glorious St. Patrick.
Hail
Adrian Gabrours is the man behind the ringing bells and has been climbing these 200 steps to get to work for 52 years now.
There's the shortcut which I usually take, which involves going up the ladder.
This may look like a type of organ, but it's not. And Adrian is not an organist. He's part of a small group of people in the world who are called a caroliner. Adrian, what is this instrument? It looks like an organ. It's not an organ.
No, it isn't. It's what, in this part of the world, we call a carillon. It's one of the loudest outdoor instruments in the world. Wow. I mean, what do you compare it with? A brass band? Yeah. You know?
A carillon is a rare instrument where a playing console is attached to bells by steel strings. This one has 49 bells and is the only one in the Republic of Ireland. And worldwide, they believe there are only around 700.
You have dynamic control over this instrument when you play it. Look, here. Very soft, very loud.
And it's amazing that as you do that, that sound is ringing out right across Cove.
Yeah.
Another unique thing about the carillon is how the weather affects its sound.
There are times when I'm playing and saying, you know, is there any point to playing at all? It's so windy, but that's not correct because it can be heard in times of storms in places where normally it wouldn't be heard.
So the wind will carry the sound to places that it wouldn't normally be heard.
Yeah.
So how did this rare musical instrument end up in the cathedral of this small fishery town in the south of Ireland? To find out, we have to go back to 1916 and a man called Bishop Robert Brown.
He was given the idea of putting a carillon in this cathedral by his nephew, Father Brown, the Jesuit, the famous photographer, who, as a chaplain to the Irish Guards in the First World War, spent a lot of time in Belgium and Holland, and he heard these bell instruments in the towers of the cathedrals, and he suggested to Bishop Brown, he said, this could be the jewel in the crown of your cathedral.
And the bells did become the jewels, but not before being christened.
They go through a form of christening of bells. They're blessed with holy water and they're given a name, as they do with a person. You can see the bell there has a logo on it.
Yes.
The year on it is 1915. Most of these bells were cast before Christmas 1915. Then they took a break for Christmas, obviously, and they cast a remainder in 1916. So some of them have 1916 written on them.
This carillon sat virtually unplayed for 8 years before Adrian's father was appointed in 1924, having turned down a position in New York to work for the Rockefellers.
Rockefeller had got interested in carillons. It's a long story. And being Rockefeller, he ordered two of the largest in the world at the time, one in New York, the other in Chicago. My father was off the job, carillonier of New York. He was all ready to go, except his mother, who was a keen cinema buff, didn't think America was a suitable country for him, because most of the films she was seeing were cowboy films. And
everyone was getting shot.
Yeah. This. So she said no, and he didn't go.
He listened to his mother.
The next job that came up was Cove.
So listening to his mother, as good sons do, instead of working with the Rockefellers in New York, Adrian's father settled on Cove in the south of Ireland, a town with a strong link to the US. For example, it's where the Titanic left on its fateful voyage to the US in 1912.
When we look out at the bay here in Cove, you think of the history. Titanic, of course, there's a great story of when the American comedians and actors Laurel and Hardy visited here and the ship was pulling up. What happened?
That was September 1953. They left New York and apparently were hardly recognized, hardly noticed. But when they arrived in Cove, the shoreline was lined with people waving at them, cheering at them. I was a primary school boy at the time, and we were let out from school to come down and see them. And the nicest thing about that story, I think, is when they saw all these people waving at them and cheering as they came in on the tender from the liner America, they didn't assume it was for them. They looked behind them to see what important person was arriving to receive such a welcome. They'd never heard a carillon before, and my father went up the tower here and played their theme song, the Cuckoo Waltz. And then it dawned to them that this was all for them.
Laurel and Hardy had, in a way, become yesterday's men in Hollywood. And they even wondered if they would be recognized when they came to Europe.
The welcome they received in Cove caught them completely off guard, and in a later interview they said that the bells ringing out from the cathedral playing their theme song brought them to tears. They were so overcome that they walked to the cathedral to see who was playing them.
And it was explained to them that it was one person, so they came up to the cathedral and met my father, and I witnessed that.
What age are you today, Adrian?
Later this year, I'll have a big birthday, and there's an 8 in it and a 0 in it.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling fine. I think it's all in the Lord's hands, of course, but you climb all these steps, that's good exercise, and then you sit down and play this beautiful music, and that's very good for the soul.
Now, it is often his granddaughters, Ella and Amy, who are playing the carillon, continuing the family tradition.
This instrument is a work of art. It's a national treasure, no less. So it can't be silent. It must be played into the future.
So next time you're passing Cove in County Cork and you hear the beautiful music coming from the cathedral, pause for a moment and listen to the bells that have been ringing out across the town for over 100 years. In Cove, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
Such a sweet sound, those bells. Thank you, Colm, for that report. And that's it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Haydrow. Please join us again next week, same time, for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.